Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucking nears? What the fuck nicks? What's happening? I am Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. How's it going? Hey, here's a reminder to all of you in Los Angeles. We are doing our only LA book talk and signing this Sunday, October 29th at 7 p.m. That's it. One night only at the Ann and Jerry Moss Theater at the Herb Alpert Educational Village in Santa Monica. And if you haven't seen me and Brendan do our thing, you will enjoy it. We'll talk about Waiting for the Punch, but we also talk about behind the scenes stuff from the podcast, some secrets that you don't know about. We take questions from the audience and we'll sign your stuff. Bring your copy of Waiting for the Punch if you already have one, or you can get one with your ticket. Go to livetalksla.org to get tickets, or go to the tour page of WTFpod.com. That's Sunday, October 29th. Livetalksla.org or WTFpod.com. Also, another thing, fans, friends, country people, or global people, everybody, international friends. Brian R. Jones has a new batch of cat mugs. If you want to get a cat mug, just like the ones I give to my guests, go to brianrjones.com to get yours. They go on sale today at noon Eastern, 9 Pacific, and they always go very fast. So do that. I'll tweet that shit too, right? I'm a little embarrassed. Willem Dafoe is here today. Willem Dafoe. I talked, you know, it's hard when you talk to a guy about acting and about a long career in acting. And I think we did all right, me and Willem. And, you know, he brought up a movie called Light Sleeper, which is a Paul Schrader film, who I'm a bit obsessed with sometimes. Paul Schrader, sort of a dark mind, dark masculine mind. That autofocus, man. He wrote Taxi Driver, Raging Bull. But we were talking about some other movie called Light Sleeper that I had not seen. And by some weird freak coincidence, this has happened a couple of times. Like, I'm on a plane. I usually fly American. And I usually fly business because I don't have children. I don't have a wife. I have some money. Can I spend it, please? Thanks. I'm giving to charity. You don't mind if I fly business, do you? So in their classic collection, or for whatever reason, I don't know, Light Sleeper is there. I mean, this is a Paul Schrader film made in like 1992. And I had talked to him about it, and I'd never seen it before. And I watched it, and I just forget that there was a tone to certain films. There's a tone to films that take their time. You know, some things are dated, but, you know, people who are auteurs, who have a very specific point of view for their films, and angle, and, you know, they're meticulous about what the script points are and what the story points are and what it's about. You know, sometimes it's not as satisfying as, you know, a movie that is fundamentally manipulative. And I forget that there's a certain patience that you need to afford. I don't know if I'd call it an art film, but an older independent film, or any independent film, that, you know, maybe you shouldn't judge too quickly. Also, it's a 1992 film, so the fashions and the tone of what's happening are a little dated. But I was surprised at who's in the damn movie. Willem Dafoe plays this guy, John Latour, who's a drug dealer. Susan Sarandon is his main, you know, supplier. Dana Delaney plays this woman who was fucked up on drugs and used to go out with Willem's character, but she got clean, and then he sort of is starting to run into her again. David Clennon, great character actor, as this other drug dealer. Mary Beth Hurt plays a psychic reader. Victor Garber, you know, the guy who designed the Titanic, plays this German aristocrat, like wealthy drug dealer, weird sex guy. Sam Rockwell is in it for like 2 minutes. Jane Addams, a child, is in it as Dana Delaney's sister. And David Spade, plays, his character is called Theological Cokehead. This guy's just jacked on coke and rambling on about God and metaphysics. It was just sort of odd to see it after. And I also watched the Meyerowitz stories, and I thought that Dustin Hoffman was great, and Ben Stiller and Adam Sandler. I'm just doing movie reviews, I guess. We're tremendous. You know, both tormented, troubled Jewish men with difficult fathers, I'm assuming, were able to really dig deep and make that fucking film, Noah Baumbach. It's his best movie, no doubt. It's on Netflix. And if you want to see Dustin Hoffman, and he makes everybody run. Noah makes everybody run. And it's interesting because I like when that happens, because in The Graduate, Dustin Hoffman is a cross-country runner for college. So, you know, there's a lot of him running in The Graduate, and he's got a very specific run. And I can only assume that Noah was like, I wonder if he's still got that run in him. And he did it. The same in like King of Comedy, where, yeah, I don't know, Jerry Lewis must have been in his late 50s or 60s when, you know, Scorsese had him in that movie, and he does a long scene where he's running from a fan, and it's just this crazy Jerry Lewis run. Sometimes running is funny and tragic, just the activity of it. So I think I feel like I just avoided telling you my shameful story. Okay, all right, I'll tell you about my shame, because maybe it will help others. But wait, before I do that, let's share a couple of emails of success stories. Subject line, thanks to you and Nikki Glazer. Mark and Nikki, with Mark's new book out, I thought I would share a moment that had a big impact on me. I am in my mid-40s, was struggling with a marriage that was falling apart, feelings of guilt about my issues as a parent, looking to infidelity to provide a quick fix and make me feel better, but only feeling worse, and finally, secretly going to a therapist, then struggling to really understand what was happening. My wife started joining me in therapy in hopes that if we could get to the root of my problems, we could get to the root of our problems. But I was not digging in, not trying to really understand why I was the way I was. Then Nikki flipped my world upside down. Quote, maybe your mom doesn't love you, unquote. And the next 10 minutes of the interview on the WTF podcast, Nikki opened my eyes to what it meant to be truly honest with yourself, to be okay thinking those things about your parents who are supposed to love you, and confront them head on. And now those things affect everything and everyone around you. I had heard Mark talk about parents with others, but Nikki was so direct, so brave. It was the first time in my life my walls came down. I was honest with myself. I was honest with my wife and kids. I accepted my parents for who they are and changed my approach to dealing with them. My marriage is so much better now. We talk about difficult things. We listen to each other, and we are better parents and fixing some of the mistakes we made along the way. This wouldn't have happened if I didn't fundamentally change what I was doing. In that moment, listening to Nikki was the jolt of reality I needed, like she was talking directly to me. I've probably listened to that part of the interview 10 times since the first time, usually when I'm having doubts about myself or feeling guilty after talking with my parents. It gives me the confidence to be true to myself, to trust my feelings. I wanted to thank you and let you know there is a special place in my heart for both of you. Sincerest thanks, Todd. Hey, man, glad to help out. And I will tell Nikki, I will give this to Nikki. I will show Nikki. Here we go. Subject line. Hi, Doctor of Cocaine Studies, Marin. Last time I sent you an email, I was around 10 days sober. It's been about 90 days now without pulling up a bottle and having a chair. And damn it, I feel great. I went from living with my parents, barely maintaining any semblance of life, to having my own bottom floor in an estate house, going back to school and working. WTF. Please, talking sobriety with your guests. It always helps to know that everyone goes through shit and either maintains, burns out, or chooses sobriety. Talking matters. Simon. All right, so there you go. Those are happy stories. So, okay, I'll tell you. There were a few guys working on the house, all right? And I had to split. So I got a guy who works for me occasionally, Frank. He was going to come over and hang out while the dudes finished up the hammering and sawing and the dude stuff outside. Yeah, I could do it. Of course I could do it, but I didn't have time. And, you know, they're pros. Doing some repair work on the home. So what happens is, you know, they're out there working, and Frank comes over. Now, I look the way I do. Frank looks the way he does. Frank's got a mustache as well, and he's wearing shorts. He's got glasses, and you know, I got my mustache and I got glasses and I'm not wearing shorts, but I got my boots on. And, you know, and I'm like, I don't know when they're going to be here till. And I already talked to them, you know, to see, you know, to tell them they were doing a good job and find out what they were doing. And then Frank goes, all right, I'll just go ask him. So he goes out and asks him. And then we're both sort of standing outside. And then I take off and I tell Frank, you know, I'll talk to you later. And then, you know, I say goodbye to the guys working there. And yeah, I don't know if you know where this is going, but I wasn't happy about it. But, you know, I drove away thinking like, man, those guys out front, they think I'm gay. They think me and Frank live in that house together and we're lovers and we're just gay as gay can be. And I don't know why it affected me, but my next thought, and this was, there was a couple of things that happened in my brain, and I don't know what it indicates about me. But like I thought, well, if they think I'm gay, they're going to fuck my house up somehow. So then I'm in this zone of like, well, this is probably how gay people feel a lot in terms of being judged. Now, I don't know if these guys thought anything. I'm making all this up in my head. I don't, I don't believe I'm homophobic unless it's me who's gay. And I'm not gay, but I was homophobic because I was scared of people thinking I was gay and what they would do. And I imagine that is some sort of twisted empathy. But the sad part is I sort of had to struggle with, you know, it wasn't going to happen. But like with, you know, driving back and somehow declaring to these three guys who are working on my house who might not be thinking anything that I wasn't gay for some reason. Just so they wouldn't fuck up my house and they would think that, you know, maybe, you know, that's the tricky part. That's the shameful part. I did not, you know, drive back to my house and stand out in front where the guys were working going, hey, you know, I have a girlfriend. All right. So it's not what you're thinking. I just sort of sat with the reality that's like, yeah, I'm okay being gay. I'm okay if me and Frank are gay to those guys. I accepted it. I came out to myself in that moment in terms of what those other people were thinking. I went through a lot in that few minutes driving away from the work being done on my house. All right, so Willem Dafoe is in this beautiful new movie called The Florida Project. It's now playing. There's a lot of Oscar buzz for his performance. I saw it and I thought it was spectacular. The director, Sean Baker, did another film that I did not see. I think it was called Tangerine, and I was sort of poo-pooed it because I was like, it was too much buzz about it. It was shot on an iPhone, and I was like, I'm not buying in. Everyone said it was good. People I respected said it was good, but I'm a dick. So I got to see that now because this was sort of a pretty astounding movie. Dafoe plays a hotel manager, and this is not even an extended stay hotel, just a shitty hotel near the Orlando theme parks. And people are living there. You know, low-income, poor people are living at this shitty hotel. And there's a sort of a whole little community and ecosystem to it. It felt like it was weird because the tone of it, you know, this guy, Baker, shoots very sort of from the hip and, you know, handheld. And it's gritty. But it had this tone because there's a lot of focus on the kids in this film. And I'm like, well, now we've got our own third world right here in this country of street children and of people that live in a compromised situation. Obviously, they've always been here, but this really shines into the tragedy of having to parent and exist in these conditions, but also this sort of relentless joy and sort of detachment that children have despite the circumstances. There's a tremendous balance in the film. And me and Willem talk about that, among other things. This is me and Willem
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
Foe. You were the last of eight?
I have a younger sister, seventh of eight.
So you're the seventh of eight?
Yeah, seventh son. Five sisters, two brothers, no.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Do you know them all?
Do I know them all? You mean like, well, I know their names. I know their names.
But no, I guess it's
and
weird.
My parents used to call anyone. Yeah. They were like, it was like, Barbara Nancy B.D. Dodden, really? They'd do the whole run.
They had to, I guess.
And everybody's ears perked up, and so they had to kind of intuit which one they really were wanting.
My mother did that with animals. There were several dogs,
okay,
and a couple cats.
So you know the thing.
It's a little insulting, though, with the animals. I mean, you should know the difference.
It's not insulting for people.
Well, you should know the basic difference between a pet and a child.
I don't know that difference. I haven't had enough pets.
No. So, oh my God. So, like, you really probably didn't really know your older siblings that well, right?
I didn't. But they raised me.
They did?
Yeah. I mean, I remember some of my early memories are, you know, my sister, my eldest sister going off to college. I was probably six.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah.
It's sad, man. It must be sort
no,
of...
No, but also...
You saw them all go.
That's okay, because they also... a lot of them, for undergrad anyway, went to the University of Wisconsin, and that was in the 1960s. So when I became a teenager, yeah, I used to hitchhike down there. And I had some of my best experience, most formative experiences on that University of Wisconsin-Madison campus as a adolescent.
Oh, yeah.
Hanging out with my, you know,
sure,
couch surfing
with, your
with my brothers and sisters, yeah.
Because they all went there?
7 out of 8, yeah. I'm the only one that didn't, actually.
And that's in Madison, Wisconsin?
And that was a lively campus, you know, up with Berkeley and
right,
some other places. There was a lot of activity.
And you were like 16, 17?
Yeah, you know, no. I first started going there when I was like, you know, 14, 15.
Wow.
Because it was only 100 miles away.
And it's a great town. I've been to that town. Yeah, it's a hip town.
Yeah. And it was, you know, and it was interesting, too, because, you know, kind of growing up in Wisconsin with kind of good, well-educated Eisenhower era, you know, Republican parents.
Right.
And then through my, seeing my brothers and sisters get radicalized through their going out in the world. And
yeah,
I think that had a big effect on me.
Well, I mean, I've talked to a lot of people about that. It's necessary, I mean, to have, if you don't have older siblings, to guide you one way or the other into the light,
yeah,
of what is interesting and cool, you might be hobbled.
Yeah. Or you may see there's another world out there a little too late.
Right. You missed it.
But then again, sometimes you see people that grow up in a little town and they can develop in a very full way, you know,
yeah, sure,
just because...
Sure, yeah, they'll develop, but like at that time, right, you know, I mean, everything's blowing up. The whole social fabric,
yep,
is coming unglued.
Yep.
Music, art,
yep,
you know, the power of creativity.
Yep.
So you were just, you were able to sort of like go see that,
yep,
as a 15-year-old.
It's true.
And what do you remember most about what was inspiring?
Well, just a kind of questioning,
yeah,
and protest,
right,
and
right,
also I remember, this is a kind of funny connection, but I think one of the things that made me start, I started making, you know, working with a small avant-garde theater company. That was really what, you know, started me as an actor.
In Wisconsin?
And continued for many years. Started in Wisconsin, but then more notably in New York and with the Wooster Group.
Right, but like that stuff in Wisconsin, was it like...
It was avant-garde in the respect that we were doing different forms. It was still, we were basically working with a playwright and we were still working with, you know, the literature,
yeah,
of...
Sure.
Of making plays, but they were, the subject matter was radical and the stagings were radical, and we were a, you know, collective of people that ran a little factory space and did everything ourselves. So that was a new form. So
in what town?
Up Milwaukee.
So briefly,
that was for like a couple of years, but it was important.
Now, your parents, like, what'd your old man do?
He was a surgeon.
Oh, my dad was a surgeon.
Yeah.
So never home.
Never home, and my mother worked with him, and she was a nurse. And she'd do, you know, he had a clinic, and he'd do the lab work, and
uh-huh,
because they were in the center of a kind of agricultural community.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it was a town of 50,000. That was kind of the hub. So people would come from far away to have their visits with him.
What type of surgeon?
He was a gastrointestinal surgeon.
Oh, okay.
Very well trained, Harvard Medical School, Mayo Clinic, you know. But he was a far, you know, he's a country boy, so he really wanted to practice in Wisconsin, you know. So these people would come from far away. He'd get called out for surgery, and my mother would be working the desk sometimes, having to, you know, calm these people down because they'd travel from far away, and they didn't want to leave, so they'd have to wait when he was called out on emergency surgery.
Sure.
And I'd be there sometimes doing, well, I worked as a janitor there, but also I used to do school work there sometimes. And I'd hear these people cuss out my mother, and she'd take abuse all day. And then my father was would come in like he was Jesus Christ, you know, and they were like, oh, doctor, and they'd give my mother a dirty look, and then they'd have their visit, and everything was nice again. And I always felt bad for my mother, because she really took a huge bullet for this guy to play the hero.
Yeah. Sure.
And that was very much the era where, you know, doctors were the word. You
bigger
know?
Than life, yeah. Yeah. It's
and he was a good guy. He wasn't a jerk. And I think he was a you know, very moral and probably a good doctor too.
But, oh, yeah.
But still, to see that growing up really blew my mind.
Yeah, yeah. The reverence and the sort of dismissal of your mom.
Yeah, and you know, kind of, yeah.
Yeah.
The service, the sexism. There were lots of stuff in that.
Oh, yeah. But you got along with him and her?
Yeah, both. Probably better him than her, because it was one of those stories that we were probably too much alike, so she would bust my balls a little bit, where he was probably more distant. It was more a symbolic relationship, but he was a disciplinarian and rigid, but we respected each other. So there was a distance, but I love both of them and had no problems.
That's great. And are you the only...
I'd fight with her a lot, though.
Yeah. Well, you got to fight with one of them.
Yeah. Because she tried to be a super mom before those things were happening. She was a working woman. Sometimes she was going to school even. And she was. And she had all these kids. But, you know, I just want to say, man, forget it. Just give up on the mother thing. Yeah. You know, do one thing or the other, because you're spreading yourself too thin. And just face it. So don't pretend like you're everywhere at the same time.
Oh, right.
You know, let us go.
Oh, I see. So a lot of the fights were like, you're not around.
It was like, you know, you'd go someplace and I'd say, I'll get a ride home with someone.
Yeah.
And in order to be sweet and to try to be a good mother, she'd say, no, I'll pick you up.
Yeah.
And then she'd forget.
Oh.
And I'd say, then I'd walk home and I'd say, where were you? And she'd say, oh man.
Right.
Oh man. And then next time it would happen, I'd say, hey, it's okay. I'll take a ride. No, I'll pick you up. And it happened again.
Yeah. That was what you unloaded.
Abandonment issues. Perfect for an actor, right?
Yeah. Is it? I guess it is.
I don't know. We're up and close and personal. I must have woke up
On
the professional side of the bed.
Well, were you the only one that went into like a creative pursuit?
No, they're all.
Like strictly an artist?
They're all professional people, but they're all more talented than I am.
No,
they are. You know, when we get together, they all sing better, they all dance better, they all act better. But I've got a tenacity they don't have.
You stuck with it. You made a life out of it.
Something like that.
They're hobbyists.
No, I'm kind of joking, but it's really funny that. No, they're. I mean, I guess I tip my hand that way because I don't want to make it sound like I come from this family of striving, professional people, and I'm the artist.
Right.
It's not true. They were all, and they are all creative people. My brother, the surgeon, you know, plays music. My brother, the lawyer, is very clever storyteller.
Yeah.
One of my sisters, the nurse.
Yeah.
She draws beautifully and writes beautifully. You know, it's like that.
No, I do. I do know what you mean. It's just that they were smart enough not to make it a living.
Maybe. Yeah.
Maybe. Yeah.
But I.
What'd you get?
Was willing to roll the dice. And I made. Got, what did I get?
Lucky seven. You got it. God damn. Yeah. So, all right. So, okay. So, this is fascinating to me. So, you know, when you started acting in high school?
Even before that, there was a community theater in my... There was a university called Lawrence University where I was, and it was a private, good school.
Yeah.
And they had a very good drama department, a very good physical space.
Yeah.
And in the summertime, some community people got together, because it was a place of means, because there were these paper mill factories and paper mills, and there were some there was some wealth there.
Some money around.
Yeah. And they made a summer theater. And they'd hire, you know, a director from New York to come for the season and direct, you know, plays.
And you were how old?
The first one I did probably was, I was probably 11.
So you were basically trained as a kid by just being in the play.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it changes. Yeah. But, yeah. And school plays and, you know, like a lot of kids when I was little, I used to write plays.
You did?
Know. Yeah.
Yeah.
They were always historic things.
Oh, really?
Titles like Cortez or the Alaska Gold Rush. They were very short. Uh-huh. I always wanted to do the action stuff, but couldn't ever quite beef up the dialogue, you know, because I wasn't really interested in the psychology. Yeah. I was interested in the doing.
Yeah, sure.
The doing, not the showing.
Yeah, yeah.
Which came a cropper later.
Yeah, but have you done a lot of writing in your life or not really?
No, not really. I mean, no, not really.
So after the experimental theater in Milwaukee, like, you know, after doing, like, you know, I would imagine that once you finish high school, you kind of committed to it.
Not really. No? What happened is I left high school early.
And yeah.
I was kind of in between things, didn't know quite what to do. Even considered joining the army, as weird as
really?
That sounds.
And this is in the mid-60s or late 60s?
No. Hey, I'm not 80, guys. This is 72.
Okay, I'll
73.
Sorry.
Yeah. You know, I just knew there was another world out there, and I wanted to find it, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So I started taking classes at university.
Where? In Madison?
And no, in Milwaukee.
Okay.
Because I had a brother-in-law, or a future brother-in-law-to-be that was there. And I stayed at his place and started taking courses and being in plays. And then these people from this Theater X saw me in that and said, you forget school. Come work with us. And
be
I did.
For
a little, yeah, a little bit.
Yeah.
Then I did that for a little while. We got picked up by a European producer, so it was exciting because I was like 18 years old and traveling in Europe with these shows and things. And I was seeing all these shows from around the world, particularly at a place called the Mickery in Amsterdam, which was very well funded with a real visionary producer who would go all around the world and select things and just bring them to his theater.
Like what type of stuff?
Oh, everything from spectacle to, you know, African dance to opera to, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
It was a flexible space, a modest space. You know, his taste was more toward the avant-garde, not traditional theater.
Mm-hmm.
But you never knew with this guy.
And you're just taking it in.
And I'm just taking it in.
Yeah.
And turned on and seeing really kind of great performers and really interesting people. And I think that's when you're at that age, you want to be with inspiring people, cool people, people that are kind of supporting this new education you're having.
Sure.
So, you know, I go from middle class, secure guy from a big family with, you know, kind of a track laid ahead of me that I should be.
Yeah.
Follow the tradition.
Yeah.
And then I enjoy, probably because somewhere I have that security in my head, you know, falling about two social classes and being, you know, living in a poor neighborhood and knowing people with drug problems and criminal records and, you know, poverty. And, you know, I always think of the Bob Dylan line, you know, a little boy lost, he takes himself so seriously, he brags of his misery, loves to live dangerously.
Yeah.
Well, that was me. You know, it's you want to get dirty.
Sure, of course.
You want to get dirty.
I can relate to that.
Because dirty feels real.
Yeah, I can relate to that. That's absolutely right. You didn't come upon it authentically, but you could visit it.
You were reaching. You knew there was something there.
Yeah.
And you wanted to know the other narrative because you were up to here with the narrative that was fed to you by all the...
Yeah.
You know, the culture that you were living
in. Sure, and you could see where that was going and what it expected of
you. Yes, yes. So, that's where we are. And then I just felt I loved the people at Theater X, but I had an ambition.
Yeah.
And I really then moved to New York, I think, to be a traditional theater actor also. I thought, you know, this acting thing, I like it.
Yeah.
And if I'm going to do something, I better, you know...
Get
serious, and go to Mecca.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I was reading about Bob Wilson, I was reading about Richard Foreman, I was reading about...
Oh, Foreman, I forgot about those plays.
I worked with him.
Oh, my God, he used to do a play like every month.
Oh, he's a great artist.
A lot of things going on.
Beautiful.
Yeah, amazing.
He is pure theater to me.
Yeah.
So is Bob Wilson. In a very different way.
Bob Wilson with the ladders and the sparse and the minimalism and the operas and the...
He does lots of things. Yeah.
But no, I like him.
I've worked with both of them.
I didn't mean to trivialize.
No, oh, good. Okay. Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah. I just remember ladders. They're like, I've always seen it a few productions.
He's got a language.
Okay. Seriously, I like
and
him.
He uses that language.
Yeah, I get it.
And that's part of the pleasure.
Yeah, I think I saw recently, he did an opera, didn't he, at Lincoln Center? I think in the last...
He does many things. Yeah. I worked with him recently. I did two shows, Life and Death of Marina Abramovich, and also, which was about Marina Abramovich. She was in it, and also Anthony Hegarty, now Anoni, did the music. It was a beautiful show. And another show, just a two-hander with Mikhail Baryshnikov and myself, called The Old Woman, based on a Russian writer.
And you did that recently?
Yeah, recently.
It's great.
We even did it at Royce Hall, which wasn't the perfect venue for it, but we were happy to bring it to L.A. We toured a lot, but very little in America, which always frustrates me because there's not the money or really the interest, I think.
No, it is... avant-garde stuff or stuff that's provocative and hard to understand seems to do better elsewhere.
Well, as far as theater, yes.
Yeah, yeah. So what what are we talking, like 73, 74 you go to New York?
We're talking, I do my little stint in university in 73, 74.
Yeah.
Then I'm with Theater X till, I try to move to New York. Theater X calls me back to the Midwest and then I go to Europe with them. And then...
with one production?
Several. 77, I'm in New York for good. And I'm intending to be a traditional theater actor.
Yeah.
But I'm looking around and I keep on finding myself going downtown. And I keep on finding myself, you know, seeking out those people I'm reading about.
77, so it's all still there.
It's all still there. It's kind of on the wane a little bit. You know, and also other things like punk has happened.
Yeah.
It's starting to happen, but it's still going on.
Yeah.
The city. You can still see the Ramones at CBGBs.
In 77. Yeah.
You're seeing, you can see television.
Yeah.
You can, you might go to a party and, you know,
Warhol's
David
still around.
Byrne may get up and do something. So there was a lot going on.
Yeah.
And that felt like what was happening rather than going around and getting a waiter job and you know.
Auditioning for Broadway.
Yeah. You know, that was kind of a throwback for me. That's the only thing I could imagine until I knew the other world. So then I get introduced to that world and I'm a square kid from Wisconsin.
But you have a little avant-garde Bonafides from.
Sure. But that
not
nickel
the real thing.
Won't get you on the subway, you know? So
where
I'm there, and then I run into, I just find myself being attracted to downtown, and I see the work of the Wooster Group, and I basically say, I want to work with you guys.
How many are there? Who's in that? I thought you were one of the guys who started it.
Yeah, well, it was born out of another group.
Yeah,
which called the Performance Group.
And who was the
That was Richard Schechner. And then people that worked with him, that was started in like 67.
Old school.
Old school, not, no, but No, old school avant-garde.
Right, right.
You know, nudity, confronting the audience, kind of a little bit in more in the living theater tradition.
Like Julian Beck?
A little bit.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not the same thing. I shouldn't say that. But just for your audience, maybe that broad's...
Right.
Okay, yeah. It's not regular plays.
Right, it's in the world of the avant-garde.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's political.
Yeah.
Okay, so I start with Richard,
yeah.
And then there's a group within the group that becomes the Wooster Group.
The Mutiny.
And that's led by Elizabeth LeCompte, and the principal other person is Spalding Gray, also Ron Vauder, Libby Howes, Jim Clayburgh. It's a group of people, and they start to make work as a sidebar to Richard.
Uh-huh.
And soon, all the energy, all the resources, and all the interest kind of shifted to them. And
Richard
also,
was all
I fell in love with Liz LeCompte, the director.
Uh-huh.
So my interest and resources and everything shifted to her. So like the dirty turncoat rat I am, I started hanging out with them.
Yeah.
And then Spalding invited me to be in the next piece. And then I started working with them in a run that lasted 27 years.
What was that piece?
That piece was probably the first one I did was Nay at School, but the first substantial one where, you know, I was really a principal performer and maker was... Point Judith.
What was a signature, like, you know, because I've seen Spalding Gray several times before he died, and right. I've seen you work. I don't think I've seen you on stage. I feel like I've been to the Wooster Group once, but what was emblematic of the Wooster Group's work?
Well, you know, people use a kind of a misnomer. They talk a lot about deconstruction, because sometimes we would use a text like a classic American play or some text.
Sure.
And we would use it as a thing, play with it, to kind of deal with it in our own terms.
Improvise with it?
No, sometimes we'd change things. Sometimes we'd cut things.
Yeah.
There was that. It was also a very physical approach. It was a very architectural approach because... the first thing the director started out with, Liz, was always the space.
Uh-huh.
She thought very spatially, very visually, very architecturally.
Uh-huh.
And then she would bring in a text, or someone would bring in a text, and we'd play with it. We'd find a way to put it on its feet. And sometimes we'd cut it radically. Sometimes we'd change it. Sometimes we'd lay something over it.
Uh-huh.
And then also another thing that I think people... was new, sort of, that we were doing is we were incorporating a lot of sound and video stuff in kind of
non-traditional ways.
We weren't hiding it.
Right.
I mean, one easy example comes to mind. In one show, we had a 93-year-old woman, in the show.
Yeah.
She couldn't make it all the time. So we put her on tape. And we'd wheel out a TV and we'd play the scene with her on tape.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the crudest thing possible. But we were using this technology in a practical way.
Yeah.
And then with time, it became more sophisticated and aestheticized. And then even further developed now, because they continue to work, they do a lot with ghosting and playing with a mix of tracks outside that are guiding them, and they're performing, riffing off the track that's either in their ears or they have a visual reference for.
Oh, that's trippy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's a very dense performance style.
Yeah.
It was beautiful work. I haven't seen it lately because I haven't been around.
But you worked with them for like 26 years.
Yeah.
On and off. And I think I remember when is it possible, did they get a new space in the late 80s? Or?
No, we had this small space called the Performing Garage that still exists.
Yeah.
But I think as the technology grew, the playing space got smaller and smaller and smaller.
Yeah.
And the other thing that I've forgot to mention.
Yeah.
It was a real company.
Yeah.
That people were working there every day.
Yeah.
And that gave us the ability to show things in progress, and it also gave us the ability to bring back old shows and put them next to new shows.
Uh-huh.
So it was a real, it was about a whole fabric of work. It wasn't just knocking off doing shows.
Right.
It was about a whole body of work, and they kind of had conversations with each other.
Right.
And that was beautiful for anyone that was really followed the company for a long time.
It was its own world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, we had a space called the Performing Garage.
Yeah.
And it got kind of small.
Mm-hmm.
And economically, it became very difficult.
Yeah.
Because we wanted to keep our ticket prices reasonable. We made our bread and butter through international touring. But even now, I think it's a struggle. And
yeah.
and through corporate, you know,
support.
Giving.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it was a struggle.
And but there's a new space now. It's not just a garage.
No, they it's have still the garage, but they do perform at Baryshnikov Space.
Oh, okay.
They have. Yeah. And they have also performed at St. Anne's.
Oh, they do a residency, like?
Yeah, a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I stopped working with them, in 2003, which is quite a long time ago. But they really formed me.
Right. And you did a lot of that international touring with productions with the Worcester Group?
Oh, yeah. And we were probably, sometimes we were 3-4 months out.
With a show that you put together or built in New York and
yep.
you take it out?
Yeah. And then it got to the point where Europeans would commission work.
Oh, yeah.
And we'd make a piece.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'd owe them, you know, dates.
Uh-huh.
And it was a good arrangement because sure. that would keep us going and would also give us deadlines.
What kind of entities would commission pieces? Theaters?
Theaters, yeah. You know, public funds.
Mm-hmm.
Because particularly in places like Germany, Belgium, some Scandinavian countries, uh-huh. also in Asia, there's either theater festivals or there's theaters that get a lot of public money just mm-hmm. to bring stuff from outside as a pleasure to
sure.
because they believe in culture.
Right.
It's they like believe culture is like education.
Right. So it turned you on from that guy in what you saw in Milwaukee who brought that stuff there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like world theater, world
yeah.
things.
Yep.
Things from outside.
Yep.
It's a beautiful yep. thing. Well, when did you start doing the movies?
79, I think.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I had kind of a false start that through a series of real complicated things, I was like a glorified extra in Heaven's Gate.
Yeah.
So I was on that movie for about 3 months.
Where did that shoot? Up in the Midwest somewhere?
Mostly around Kalispell, Montana.
Uh-huh.
Also in Idaho and
uh-huh.
some other places. But the main first thing was happened to be Catherine Bigelow's first film.
Uh-huh.
She co-directed it with another guy, with a guy named Monty Montgomery.
That was
a little film called The Loveless.
With Robert Gordon.
You know it.
The rockabilly guy.
You know it.
I've got his records in the house.
Okay. Yeah, with Robert.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was a motorcycle movie.
Uh-huh.
Very stylized.
Was it sort of campy? Was it sort of tongue-in-cheek? Or was it she's playing it straight?
Pretty straight.
Oh, yeah.
Pretty straight. You know, it was more... You know, it was more Kenneth Anger than Wild One.
Right, got it. Yeah,
it wasn't melodrama. You'll go back to Wild One. Everyone remembers it being pretty cool, but it's pretty funny.
Yeah, it's silly. Yeah, sure.
Kenneth Anger, if you looked at him now, you know, Scorpio Rising, or it's
still
probably not funny.
No, still not funny.
Yeah, yeah. It's you know, it's but the approach is very much about the surface of mm-hmm. things and what we see. So it's very stylized. It's very, you know, I remember it ran for a long time as a midnight movie in London, and its audience was, you know, was really into the kind of fetishism of the leather
sure.
and these guys hanging out. And
yeah,
that was.
Was it a period piece?
It was.
Wow. So that was your first full starring role.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I thought this is fun.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
You go someplace with a bunch of strangers. You become close really fast. You figure this thing out.
Yeah.
You have to deal with where you are.
Yeah.
You've got a basic idea,
yeah.
and that changes.
Yeah.
You make it. As you're making it, you're changed.
Yeah.
And You do that,
and then it's and then you have evidence,
and you've made everything. Yeah, you've made something.
Yeah,
and then that informs the next thing.
And is that what informed, like,
one step closer to the grave?
Yeah, that's the next thing
with a flourish.
That's the ultimate next thing. Wait, but is that what got you
hooked?
Well, not hooked, but I mean, like, when what did. Because, like, Streets of Fire is another kind of leather adventure in a way.
It is. And the funny thing is, because...
I had Walter Hill in here.
Ah, Walt's very cool. Yeah. That movie was so much fun, and he's great. I loved him. And that was a very special movie for me. Walter Hill was friendly with Catherine.
And yeah.
I think Catherine showed him a little piece of Loveless.
Yeah.
And... he got the idea to cast me in Streets of Fire, which was my first studio film.
Yeah.
And so that was, and then really out of that, then I started saying more. I got a manager. A woman called me up. I was in the phone book still then.
In New York.
And she called me up after seeing The Loveless at a film festival.
Uh-huh.
And she said, do you want to do some more of this? I think I can help you.
Yeah.
So a combination between her name was Phyllis Carlisle,
uh-huh.
and Catherine showing Walter Hill this little piece from The Loveless, that was like the beginning of my
journey.
Professional career.
Professional film acting career.
Yeah, I loved it.
Well, I mean, I'm trying to remember the first time I saw you. I guess it might have been Platoon, but I remember being extremely excited about, because Friedkin hadn't made a movie in a while when To Live and Die in L.A. came out.
Right.
And it when, like, me and my friend were kind of film heads. We're like, Friedkin's doing a movie.
Yeah.
Willem Dafoe's in it. And
To Live and Die in L.A. happened before Platoon.
Oh, so that was it then?
Yeah.
That was the first one.
Yeah.
That I can't, like, I was in high school and and we were thrilled about it.
Ah, cool.
And we're really thinking about it, man. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's fair. It's
a good movie to think about. I watched it again recently and it holds up, and I talked to Friedkin in here.
He's great.
That was a hell of a 3-hour thing.
I bet.
It was great.
Yeah.
But like that movie was challenging, I think, in some ways, because it did, you know, it had a lot of provocative stuff about morality and about...
you know, it's funny because one thing that I remember, and maybe this may or may not be important, but it was sort of a critical failure initially.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that was fairly consistent in the criticism, and I read criticism in those days, was this movie is basically misconceived because there's nobody to relate to because everybody is just awful. Morally,
yeah.
Who do we? The implication was, if you don't have a good guy to root for, you can't tell the story.
Yeah, what good is the movie?
Yeah, which is funny, you know, pre Tarantino and pre many things.
But also, like, post 70s, there were plenty of antiheroes around. I mean, I don't know what they're. It must have been the 80s.
Yeah, but they kind of.
Yeah,
the sense was they kind of flipped.
You know? Yeah, that's right.
Because if an antihero in a certain milieu, it reads like a hero.
This was
just flat out criminal people.
Yeah.
I mean, they had their reasons. I had this beautiful role of a artist criminal.
Yeah.
I think good combination.
You were the most honest character in some ways.
Yeah.
In a funny way. Well, I mean, you weren't hiding what you were, you know, doing in the sense that
you're probably more fun to have dinner with.
Yeah, exactly. But Friedkin, was that, like, you, because I was looking at the, you know, all the different movies, and you've worked with some amazing directors, and you've worked with some directors many times.
Yeah.
And I imagine they all have a different approach, and you're pretty, you know, you're willing, you know, creator, you know, like, what was your relationship with someone like Friedkin?
You know, he was the maestro. I think he was a little, you know, he was doing it his own way then because he was sort of out of the studio system, and he thought, well, I'm going to make this film. He found a guy to, you know, put
finance
up the money,
finance
it.
Yeah.
And they were going to basically, I think they call it fourth wallet, you know, they were going to put in theaters. And, it was a very direct, you know, he wanted to keep it simple, direct.
Yeah.
He wanted actors that nobody had associations with. He didn't want stars because he wanted a grittiness. He wanted for people to, you know, have no associations outside of the movie.
Right.
So he's the maestro. We're a bunch of wet behind the ear kids.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
playing these worldly heavy guys. So, you know, that's where the acting comes in.
Was he a hands-on kind of director?
Very much.
Oh, yeah.
Very much, yeah. No, I never knew what to expect. Sometimes, you know, you'd come to the set and he'd say, you know, we're not doing that because I was driving home last night. I saw a really cool location.
Uh-huh.
And we rewrote this and I found this really interesting guy. So here's the new scene. We're going to shoot this today.
Uh-huh.
He's very fluid, very open to
That's
inspiration.
Exciting,
very exciting.
Yeah, because I imagine, you know, working like with the type of actor that you were in theater, that like it must be exciting
normal.
To me.
Yeah. It's normal.
Yeah, right. Now, outside of working with the Worcester Group and being all hands-on and engaged, did you train at all in any formal way outside of college?
Not really.
Yeah.
I mean, mostly by doing.
Sure.
And even at college, I was, I went to university at a time that it was really interesting because University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee was like a street,
uh-huh.
was a blue-collar
right.
campus.
Yeah.
It was about, you know, immigrant kids going to school for the first time. It was about mothers after having kids returning to school. It
uh-huh.
was about Vietnam veterans coming back. So it wasn't Yale Drama School.
Right.
But you had lots of different kinds of people.
Yeah.
And also the faculty was very eclectic. And I think that really had a stamp on me.
Sure.
Because, you know, there's no one way. It keeps a flexibility and an appreciation that there's many ways to skin a cat, you know?
Yeah, sure.
And, sorry, you love cats.
Oh, no, you can skin a cat.
Okay.
Metaphorically, I can handle it.
Okay. I just occurred to me.
No, okay. I'm a big boy.
Okay.
You take personally.
Okay. So that's worth mentioning.
Yeah. Sure. I need you to explain a couple of things to me.
Uh-oh.
No, you did two movies with Oliver Stone.
Yep.
And Platoon was a huge break for
yes.
you. That was a life changer.
Very important, yeah.
Like, I just turned that movie on the other night, and it was in the middle. I was flipping through cable, and it was right at the scene where you get shot.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like one of the most brutal moments in film and in some weird way.
Mm-hmm.
Just completely, you know, that sums up some part of the Vietnam
yes.
experience.
Yeah.
And then you did, you had a nice part in Born on the 4th of July. Now, working with him, it would seem to me that him and Friedkin in intensity are similar.
Yes.
Yeah. And when you did
very different, but similar in intensity.
Right. And how did, when you were doing Platoon, entering that world and seeing that script and knowing what was going on, what were your feelings, you know, about doing it?
I was really excited.
Yeah.
You had this guy telling a personal story. You had all these Vietnam vets, including Oliver, advising you and training you. You were playing soldier, you know.
Yeah.
You grow up, I was born in 55, so I grew up with, you know, World War II movies,
yeah.
Korean movies,
yeah.
and then I
Real
also,
Vietnam.
And then you lived through Vietnam,
yeah.
and I'm just old enough, I think my year was the last year of the draft.
Yeah.
But this thing of being a soldier is mm-hmm. part of our culture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, look at our military spending.
Yeah,
it's, you can't escape it. And I think as far as also stories and fantasies, and it's all wrapped up in there. So
yeah.
the opportunity to play in this story that's personal and lets us kind of tell the story of these people, it was thrilling.
Yeah, yeah. And it was a great story.
And there was, you know, you hear these things, but there's such camaraderie, and
mm-hmm.
it was a young cast, you know, that once you got there, Hollywood, it was a million miles away. We were just a bunch of kids playing war and trying to figure stuff out, but guided with this story.
And was that Berenger? He hadn't done a lot either, had he?
No, he was the old man of the group. He was a well-known actor, and he had done many things.
Big Chill, maybe? I can't remember.
I don't know, but he was the most
yeah.
well-known actor.
And it was Sheen. And
Charlie Sheen, who was still fairly new.
He's great.
And then
a lot of
first-time people.
Yeah. And then he did Born on the 4th of July, which was an after-Vietnam movie.
Yeah, yeah.
And... But I guess the guy I want you to help me out with, because I'm sort of fascinated with him. Yet, and because you've done four movies with him, you must have an understanding of what's compelling and what's, you know.
Abel?
Not Abel, Paul Schrader.
Ah, Paul Schrader. I've probably done more than four movies.
Yeah?
Yeah. You know, he...
He wrote Taxi Driver.
He wrote... And he's done many beautiful movies.
Yeah.
And everybody always describes him as the writer of Taxi Driver, which is like...
Well, no, I know that, but I've watched his movies. But like, you know, that Taxi Driver, I think the reason that's important is that he's able to excavate a certain darkness.
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like when I saw Affliction, you know, I was like, what is going on?
Well, that's,
where am I?
You got to remember, Affliction comes from a very strong novel, too.
Yeah.
By Russell Banks.
Right. Okay.
So that's.
Okay. So that's
a very particular one.
Yeah.
It doesn't make it any
less
anything, but I want to point that out. I mean, the ones, you know, the first time I did something substantial with him was Light Sleeper.
Yeah.
Which was. You know, he was talking about something he knew,
mm-hmm.
and it was kind of a white-collar, you know, drug world of New York.
Yeah.
And it was thrilling to play that part because it was the kind of part that, you know, that guy could have been me if my life was different.
Sure.
And also, I shot very little in New York, and it was a very naturalistic in its style for the most part. And it was really fun to... play genteel drug dealer for a while.
Yeah.
A guy that was searching.
Yeah.
And it was a role that hit me at the right time, and it meant a lot to me. But his style is very, a little distant. You know, I think he...
Schrader?
Yeah, he deals with very hot things in a very cool way.
Yeah.
And I like that.
Yeah.
Because it makes them... burn all the hotter.
Yeah. Well, I think autofocus like a masterpiece.
Oh, good. Autofocus is fun.
Oh,
that was really fun. And, you know, that's not a widely seen film, but yeah, Paul has a good nose. He really is good at smelling what's in the air, you know?
I thought his sort
did
of...
Did you see Dog Eat Dog recently?
I didn't know. I got to see it. I didn't know about it.
Yeah.
And when was that?
It's a little wacky. Yeah, 2 years ago.
With Nick Cage.
Yeah. Yeah,
I haven't seen him do something, you know, I just haven't seen him lately. Nicolas Cage, yeah.
Nick, oh, he works all the time.
Yeah, but he does big, weird kind of franchise movies sometimes.
He does.
And I don't see a lot of the little ones. I didn't see the second Bad Lieutenant. Were you in that as well?
No.
Oh. But yeah, how is he doing, Nick Cage?
He seems good.
Yeah?
He seems good. You know, I think he wants to find, you know, he appreciates the tentpole movies and you know, he's still very bankable, but...
Yeah.
I think he still wants to...
Do weird movies?
That's one way of saying it. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
But like with the autofocus, you know, I saw it a couple times when it came out, and his sort of like that preoccupation with equipment.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought it was pretty fascinating.
Yeah, and also it was... I love movies, and like this movie that, you know, I'm kind of talking about a lot now, Florida Project.
Yeah, I love that movie.
The cool thing about autofocus is the making of the film had such parallels to the film itself. You know, the way we made it informed things so much because we were making this in the shadow of Hollywood on a shoestring budget.
Yeah.
About some guys with this, you know, and
video.
You know, and we're hiring these girls, you know. I don't know. There was something, and it wasn't...
It was a reflection.
Yeah,
yeah.
It was really fun.
A dark reflection.
Really were able to inhabit this world because we were living it in a parallel way.
Yeah, in that scene, like the sort of like there's a moment in that movie that I just will that where everything is just broken down to a degree where you're just consumed by this compulsion, the sex addiction.
Yeah.
But it's just you and Kinnear on that couch, just both of you jerking off at opposite ends of the couch, just sharing a memory.
Okay.
That moment with the casualness of it, where, you know, where you're in something that is that bizarre and that it's become commonplace.
It's normal.
Yeah. Yeah. I just think that's a fun scene for some reason.
Yeah.
And then,
no, that was a fun movie. I enjoy working with Paul.
Is he a dark guy on set?
No, he's a happy guy on set because he likes to work, but
yeah.
He's the dark guy in general.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he's serious.
And Abel Ferrara, how many movies did you do with him?
Five, I think, and I'm going to make some more.
How's he doing?
He's doing great. You know? He has a nice clean lifestyle, a new baby.
Good.
I'm the godfather to his child.
Oh, that's great.
He's my neighbor in Rome.
What is it about his vision that you like so much?
I don't know about his vision. I like him.
Yeah.
And he also
movies.
Encourages the way we work. I really feel like a collaborator,
mm-hmm.
you know? And the sad thing is he's not widely distributed
yeah.
here. So people are really ignorant of a movie like Pasolini. It isn't even present here.
Yeah. There's a few of your movies I wanted to watch. I can't find.
It's very different.
Lars Van Trier stuff is not on iTunes.
That's ridiculous.
I couldn't find Antichrist.
That's ridiculous.
Right?
We're living in a very puritanical country.
That might be a corporate issue, but maybe
it is.
Right.
It is, but the same thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because they're the hand of the.
Yeah.
They're the instrument of. Keeping the machine going.
But with Pasolini, that shouldn't be the issue. That's just bad distribution, huh?
Yeah, I don't know what it is.
Hmm.
I mean, you know, you hate to complain, you know.
Right, sure.
But the truth is, it's really a mystery to me. Because even from a pure, grubby commerce standpoint, if you put that on some platform, you know, one of these video on-demand platforms, any gay kid that's in Iowa someplace and feels like he can't connect with, you know, icons of a certain kind of culture or that express certain things, you know, should be able to see that movie.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
There's enough out there. And besides Pasolini was such a brilliant thinker. And whether you like the movie or not, there is enough expression of what he did in the movie that it's going to be worth it.
And then you can go see his work.
Exactly.
And it inspire you to see his
exactly.
work. Exactly. Well, hopefully maybe people listening will get out there. I mean, I want to see it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm also a big fan of Mississippi Burning. Obviously, you know, I could go through all your movies.
Okay. You're a little top heavy on the front. So obviously, you know, you can always tell where people watch movies and where they stop watching them less.
Well, I just didn't get down the list.
Oh, okay.
I've seen Cry Baby, Wild at Heart. I saw
I'm sorry. Yeah. I shouldn't bust the
right.
balls, but you get it?
Yeah, sure I do. But I went and saw the new film.
What happens is when people are young, they have more time.
Sure.
They're going out, and film was placed in our culture a little differently.
That's right.
And now when it's harder to find, sometimes certain kinds of movies, you got to be a cinephile.
You got to go. You can't watch them easily. Like, I didn't see the Von Trier films, either of them, and I'm upset about it because I missed the window.
You got to see Antichrist.
I do got to see it. Was that a challenging, amazing thing for you?
I just think it's a beautiful movie, and it's not what people think it is.
Well,
I think it's not for everyone, but I think he has such a nose for exploring the unspeakable, you know, really taboos in a constructive way. And he always gets labeled as just being transgressive and kind of a trickster and, you know. But I think there's something in his character that he really knows how to, you know, look under the rocks.
Sure.
And he's a great filmmaker. I mean, there's some images and some sequences in that for me are like incredibly beautiful.
Yeah, I
but it's rough too, so I get it when someone says, oh, I can't take it.
I think I can handle it.
Yeah, I'm sure you can. I'm sure you can.
Well, see, he's part of the Dogma filmmakers, right?
Yeah, he was one of the main guys, but I think, you know, that was a period of time.
Well, yeah, because I saw
everything
another one,
shifts.
The Celebration shifts. I saw, and I don't think he directed that one, but it was
that was a
hell of a movie that dealt with some of the same taboos.
Yep.
It's pretty wild. Shadow of the Vampire, very good.
Okay.
And I think you're pretty good in everything, personally.
Good.
I'm a fan.
Okay. Good.
But you work with Cronenberg, too, which must have been interesting. I saw that movie. That's not an easy movie to find.
Right.
Existence.
Right.
I don't even know if it's a favorite of Cronenberg's. I don't know. He's a very controlled dude, man. Like, he knows exactly.
No, and his sets are beautiful.
Yeah.
It's really fun to work with him.
Because he feels like, not unlike, I imagine, I don't know, Wes Anderson. Very
a little
controlled.
Bit.
Controlled
he sees it.
Sees
it.
Not a lot
he
of
sees
wiggle
it.
Room.
Yeah, but you'd be surprised.
Yeah?
You know, the irony is when when you have a good structure and it's sane, the wiggle room is inside.
Oh, you.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
And you're free. Uh-huh. And you don't lose a certain kind of energy or have a certain kind of anxiety. It's like you can focus better and you can go deeper because you're not, there's a security, but at the same time, the security, you got to punch out, you know?
I get it. So like, you know, they know what their work is like, kind of, you know, left you only so many choices around their work,
yep.
But your work.
Well, it's like if, yeah, it is about choices and about where to direct your energy.
Yeah.
And if it's articulated, then you have to work in a more focused way in a clearer field rather than having an old whole field and kind of be, have this gun to your head to be clever or invent or interpret. Uh-huh. You don't worry about that.
Yeah.
When you're got a strong language and a strong structure, then you're just trying to survive and live and keep it alive. And somehow in that, that's where you become engaged.
Right.
Because you aren't,
it
becomes practical.
Right.
Yeah, you lose yourself.
Yeah.
You lose yourself and deeply, you connect with yourself more because you throw away a lot of the surface things of identity and thought, and you get to a more intuitive state, a state that you didn't even know you had because you're kind of put in a corner.
Yeah.
And you got to figure it out.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, in the moment.
Yeah.
Well, how did that apply to the Florida project? It looked like that was a little looser than obviously a Cronenberg or an Anderson film, but it was one place.
The Florida project was beautiful because Sean Baker is really great at using concrete, real elements and mixing fictional elements or designed elements in them, with them.
Uh-huh.
And they started out with a really strong screenplay. From Sean and his writing partner, Chris Burgosh.
And that's what you got first?
And it was beautiful. And you could shoot that. And we did shoot that. But we also shot other stuff.
Yeah.
And sometimes also there would be alternate takes.
Sure.
Or with the children, there's a lot of kids in this movie, and they're children, not actors. They're children first, let's say.
And they were great.
And they were great. Particularly the central girl, she's 6 years old, and she's a natural, you know, she's a little firecracker.
Yeah.
What I'm saying is that you can have both.
Yeah, sure.
And when you have a structure, that can let you, you know, that can make you a little looser. Mm-hmm. That's the irony. If you're spending too much time looking for that structure, I don't know.
Well, no, but it was interesting because watching you, that, you know, when your presence was there all the time.
Well, I had a very clear job.
Yeah.
You know?
You're the manager of the hotel.
And that's what I did. What did I do?
Yeah.
I managed this motel.
Yeah.
And we were shooting a movie there.
Yeah.
And it was like the I love it when the, you know, the line between real life, agreed on life, you know.
Yeah.
Communally accepted reality
gets
thrown out for our special reality. Like the manager would be sitting there and we'd have to shoot a scene in the office and they'd like, okay, can you guys step out? We'll go in, you know?
Oh, so that
and
was like that. That
a
was,
little bit like that.
So there were people living at that hotel.
Oh, yeah. It was a functioning motel.
Yeah.
And sometimes we'd be in the middle of scene and people would come to check in.
Yeah.
And we weren't a big crew.
Right.
It was very small crew.
Yeah.
So it's like, don't go in there. Don't go in there. We're shooting, you know? It's not like we had lots of equipment trucks.
But everybody's on hands on deck with that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And then and then you've got kids running around.
Yeah.
And then you've got, you know, people with real challenging lives, you know, coming out to see the circuses down.
Yeah.
It was really...
How did
it
that affect
really
your, you feel like, how did it affect your performance being in the presence of, you know, what was real destitution and real desperation?
It keeps you honest.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't make a bullshit movie. You got to honor those people.
Yeah.
And you aren't, they don't become, they stop being those people and they become your people.
Yeah.
Because you're one of them.
Right.
Just by sheer proximity, you're talking to them, they're telling you stories. That informs everything. Mm-hmm. You know, you're down with them.
Yeah.
And it may be temporary, and you have no illusion, you know, it's a tough world.
Sure.
Because, this world that we're talking about, for people that haven't seen the movie, is a world of people living in low-cost motels in an area in Central Florida near the amusement parks that don't have permanent residences. So they're long-term temporary residences in these motels. And it's the kind of Kmart thing that, they pay as they go. You know, the old, you know, when someone doesn't have a lot of money, they go to Kmart, they say, wow, I can get a grill for $20. Well, they end up buying 20 grills over their lifetime, and that grill lasts about 2 months. It goes in the landfill, and next year they have to buy it again. If they bought a nice grill in the first place, then they'd have some stability. They'd pay a fraction as much, and you wouldn't have many grills in the landfill.
Right.
So we're really, you know, we're a dog chasing its own tail,
sure,
you know?
Sure.
And this expresses that cycle a little bit.
Yeah.
Because it's a very precarious position, because they have trouble after the a little bit of the crash and the housing crisis. Mm-hmm. A lot of people, you know, can't find a place to live because they can't afford the down payment, mm-hmm. or they can't do the security checks, or they can't do the
They can't. They've fallen out.
Yeah, they've fallen out. They slipped through.
And I thought it was fascinating because you know the kids, the energy of the kids, is what buoys, you know, the emotional tone of that movie.
Oh yeah, it's, you know, the kids are very present, and you see kind of a joyful chaos of the kids.
Yeah,
but then you have this shadow of the difficulty of the adults, and you kind of see a life, and that's what appeals to me about it, without wagging fingers or even necessarily giving a solution.
That's right.
It just shows a world that's in kind of trapped in a loop.
Yep. And it's interesting at the end, you know, because your character is about midway through, you start to realize, like, well, this guy's, you know, I don't know what it is, but he's been compromised somehow.
Who hasn't?
No, I'm not.
That's the point.
It's not a judgment.
No. I mean, I'm joking.
Yeah.
But
absolutely.
I mean, that's sort of the point.
Well, it's not overplayed. You don't even know what it is. I imagine that guy helping you move was your son, right?
Yeah.
And it's sort of like, I don't know what happened here.
But
this is where he ended up.
Yep.
And he's only one tier above the people, only in the sense that he's got a job. Is the only difference between him and the people living there.
That's absolutely right. And I think that's why this isn't, you know, this isn't it's a small movie, but it's not a depressing movie, and it's not
it's a
limited movie,
because
it points to this impulse that we have to try to make good of a limited situation.
Yeah.
And it's that balance that we try to do between acceptance, but also forging ahead, trying to make it better. And Bobby, my character is, you know, without telling people before they see the movie too much, but he's a simple guy.
Yeah.
You know, there's nothing on the surface extraordinary about him.
Yeah.
But he makes stuff work somehow because he's good hearted, and the big takeaway for me is
not judgmental.
No, he recognizes that my happiness is dependent on your happiness. Which is a very important equation to learn that we all know, but we don't get a chance to practice very often, because we're bred on competition, get ahead of the other guy, you know, if he falls behind, that gives you more room to go ahead, you know, and it's really about cooperation and compassion and helping each other.
I tell you, the movie, like, it felt to me a little like some of those movies made in about kids in sort of like Latin American movies, and some of the, I don't remember titles.
No, I like Pixote or something.
Pixote, right. Like that there's these kids living in poverty in these third world countries, and now
they're doing great, but you know it's not going to last forever.
Oh, no. And then now this is an American version of that and I haven't really.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it felt that way to me, that, you know, the joy and relentless exuberance of these kids are the only thing that makes this not a depressing movie.
Right. But also my guy.
Your guy, too.
You can identify with him because he's an everyman.
And even the woman who plays the mother, you know, you're rooting for her on some level. It's all very compelling, and it isn't sad. It's sad, but it's not depressing. But at the end of the movie, you're confronted with some interesting things in yourself, and yep. I don't want to give away much.
Right. No, Sean has done a beautiful job.
No doubt.
It's very balanced, and it's...
I didn't see the first one.
It's
either.
Complete. It's complete and whole,
yes.
But it's not closed.
That's right.
It's got plenty of room for the audience to participate.
Yeah.
That always sounds like a lot of work when you say that to people, but it's a pleasure, I think.
Well, I like those kind of movies where, you know, it is open enough for it to challenge a person's individual sensibility without, you know, you're not, it's not a closed system. That's right. Yeah. And what are you working on now? You doing something?
I just wrapped on a film called Aquaman.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Is it a big superhero movie?
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. James Wan directing, Jason Momoa, Amber Heard.
What are you doing?
Patrick Wilson. I play a good character. I play a character that's kind of the mentor to Aquaman.
Uh-huh.
He's also a politician that is the kind of the Lord Chamberlain or the guy to Patrick Wilson, who is the king.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
Yeah, there'll be plenty of time to talk about that. But that just finished that. James Wan, a great director.
Oh, good.
Big movie, big muscular fun movie.
And you did the Orient Express?
I did the Orient Express.
That's a remake?
It's a
third one?
I don't know what they call them. Reboots, remakes, refiguring, reimagining. But Kenneth Branagh, an incredible, a nutty lead.
He directed it?
Yeah.
Oh.
And he stars as Poirot.
Oh, okay.
And it's a fantastic cast. Very stylish, great script. I haven't seen it yet, but it was really fun to do. And then, now I'm off to France to do a film with Julian Schnabel.
Another one. He did, which one did he do? Basquiat.
He did Basquiat. He did Diving Bell and the Butterfly.
Are you in that?
He did. I did a little cameo in Basquiat. I was in Morale, which was his last one.
I like Diving Bell and the Butterfly.
And he also did... Before Night Falls, which is a beautiful film
that
Javier Bardem was so good in.
That's a good movie.
Yeah.
I liked his paintings, too.
Yeah, he's a great artist.
Yeah, he is.
And he's fun to work with.
Yeah.
I've only worked with him in very small ways because we know each other.
So this is
friends.
A big way? Is this going to be a big
this
one?
This is a big way. No, it's not a big movie. It's a smaller movie, but it's a beautiful. It's Van Gogh at the end of his life.
Oh, wow.
You know, at the period where he was really most productive, but also most challenged, let's say.
Yeah, and
so
you're Van Gogh.
I'm playing Van Gogh. And
what do you do to prepare for that?
Right now, I'm growing my beard.
Yeah.
Learn how to paint.
Uh-huh. You do?
Read the letters between him and his brother.
And Theo.
Read A Life.
Uh-huh.
You know, this very well-researched biography.
Mm-hmm.
But also... Julian leads the way because one of the beautiful things about Julian is, like all great directors, you know, when you come down to it, it's like you got a room, you bring stuff into the room that means something to you or resonate with you or signify something for you. And then you order it, you make a relationship, and that relationship and what happens kind of makes its own story. Everybody's story. You know, expressing your point of view or, you know, explaining.
Yeah.
The best things always happen when you're able to tap into this kind of process of making something.
Yeah.
And someone like Julian understands that so deeply. That's why when he started making movies, then everybody said, my God, he's a filmmaker.
Yeah.
It's like, it's a little bit like, duh.
Yeah, of course he is.
Yeah, of course he is.
Yeah.
Starts so anyway, I bring that up. There's plenty of time to talk about that too.
Sure,
but I'm excited. I leave in a couple of days.
And you live almost exclusively in Rome now?
No, I work a lot, so I live in Rome and New York. Mm-hmm. But lately a little bit more in Rome.
That must be nice.
It's a beautiful place. Yeah. I mean, you know, they've got their challenges, but
speaking of
time, call me foolish.
Yeah.
See, sí, abbastanza bene.
Enough.
Yeah, I have to study every day.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you look great, and you're doing great work, and it was a thrill to talk to you.
Okay, cool.
Thanks, man.
Yeah.
that was me and Mr. Defoe. It was great talking to him. It's nice out here. I'll play some guitar. I'll play some redundant guitar on my gold guitar and my old ass amp. Boomer lives.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.